What is up, Pod Nation, or I guess I should say Pod World, since we're international. This is episode 46, and we're going to geek out today. But first, I want to showcase our social media. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram. We're super active there. We are also always checking our email, pottyaslavepodcast@gmail.com. Send us ideas, feedback. We'd love to hear from you. And we've heard from some fans internationally, which is always a delight. So thanks to everyone out there. And I'm going to send it over to Tone. What do we got going on tonight?
Yeah, so we had a guest tonight, and we didn't do our typical interview format. We had a little bit of a different world for that. Tuan's going to explain that to you in a second. But we had Brendan Groen from Incendiary, Long Island native. And Tuan, what exactly did we talk about tonight?
Yeah, so we've been kind of brainstorming, you know, the last, whatever it's been, year since we started this podcast. We've been wanting to do a regional deep dive, and we'd thrown out like SoCal to do like the SoCal punk thing. We'd thrown out Minneapolis to do the whole like Rhymesayers hip hop thing, but we kept coming back to Long Island, New York. If you've listened to this podcast, you know I love the Crime and Stereos, the Glassjaw. We all love Glassjaw, you know, the TBS, the Brand News, dating back to Silent Majority, all that stuff. We love that stuff. And there's this intrigue with that region. You know, the bands rep the area so hard. There was this explosion of bands dating back to the mid-90s to the present. And we're all just super fascinated by the region. And we get into it in the episode with Brendan, that it just, the lyrics paint this visual of the island. I use the island in quotes, that you just kind of want to know more. So we'd thought about doing this episode, just the three of us, and we said, you know what, let's try to get someone on who lived it, who grew up in the area, who's our same age, which Brendan is, and bonus points is in a band. And we, if you've listened to this podcast, you know we love Incendiary, so it was kind of the perfect storm. Like he was the first person we thought of for this episode. So we reached out, and he was game.
Yeah, in a band we love too, which is cool. So yeah, here is our conversation, a deep dive on Long Island and the music that came from there with Brendan Groen of Incendiary.
All right. We are here with Brendan Groen of Incendiary, a Long Island native. Is that right, Brendan?
Born and raised. Yeah. And actually just made my great return 3 months ago. But before that, I hadn't lived here for a long time.
Oh, so you're back living on the island.
I'm back living on Long Island. Yep. When I was 18, I went away to college, and then I moved to New York City, and I was there for like 13 years and just moved back to Long Island.
Nice.
Jeez, we picked the right person for this segment.
Perfect timing.
This is perfect. Yeah, timing. So this is the Long Island deep dive. We're going to keep it in the punk, pop punk, hardcore, in a Jace lane, just because, you know, we love music. We'd be talking for 10 hours if we included everything. So let's take it back. We're thinking 25 years. That's when Nate, Tony, and I all got into music, back when we were like 10, 11. It wasn't these bands, but, you know, the Green Days, the Offsprings, which obviously shaped a lot of what we like today. But yeah, so back 95, mid-90s, you have a lot of legacy Long Island bands either hitting their stride or just starting. So I'm talking about Glassjaw is active back then, Kill Your Idols just forming, Silent Majority, who you're wearing the hoodie. Our listeners can't see this, but Brendan's wearing a Silent Majority hoodie.
Just a little plug.
A little plug there. And Vision of Disorder, VOD, they put out their full length. So I obviously missed this in real time, you know, early 2000s, went back and revisited this. So Brendan, were you were probably too young, right, to experience this in real time?
Yeah, I mean, so for, yeah, I kind of, this age is interesting. I'm 36. I caught the tail end of like that real, like golden age height of Long Island, which I would kind of say was like mind over matter into VOD, and then VOD was just like went to a whole nother level. And so right before I started to go to shows, it was Neglect, it was VOD, it was Silent Majority. 95, 96 was kind of like a big height of that, right? Because you had this venue called the PWAC, which was like this big warehouse that I never went to. So I'm not kind of like fronting that I was front and center every show. 10, so like, 10. Yeah, I mean, I kind of just missed that. I mean, you know, I can get into that, but like, yeah, right at that time you had Neglect, you had VOD, you had Silent Majority, and VOD, once they kind of started popping off a little bit, was drawing literally like 1,000 people at like a local show, like 1,200 kids at, you know, a VFW hall or whatever. So it was just like unprecedented scale of all local bands, which is kind of nuts. And then for me, I started to go to local shows right in probably like, I think 1998 was maybe my first show, 97, 98. And that was kind of on the tail end of that, with some more like punk stuff in the area that I was from. I'm from Smithtown. So I missed a lot of that, like the real great, like the VOD set on YouTube that's like kind of famous, like stuff like that.
It's funny. I listened to the Axe to Grind podcast, and Tom Sheehan, he mentioned a record release show. It must have been their second album, which drew 2,500 people on the island, which is kind of crazy. I mean, they were a Roadrunner band, but that's still bananas. Like, we don't even have a venue that is in that space. You know what I mean? That 2,500 cap up in Maine.
They also, like, VOD transcended hardcore at that time. Like, yeah, they went on to sign to Roadrunner and everything, but even before that, like, you can always find some dude between the ages of like 35 and 45 that is like, yeah, fucking VOD, like the mechanic at the place in the South Shore of Long Island who has like absolutely nothing to do with hardcore. Like, my random older cousins knew VOD. They were like, they were bigger than just the little insular hardcore scene. That's like how massively popular they were at the time. It's crazy.
That's awesome. Is that how you discover this music? Is just through little mini connections here and there and kind of brought it to the forefront?
I got into this kind of music primarily through local shows. I was really into playing the drum when I was a kid, kind of got into the whole skate, the Pennywise of it all. Like, I loved Pennywise and Rancid, like probably like so many people our age. And then I heard Strife, actually, which is not a local band, from California, obviously. And that was like one of the first main hardcore bands that I heard, in conjunction with the era that kind of I grew up with, which would be like bands like Subterfuge and The Backup Plan. Subterfuge guys went on to do This Is Hell, and The Backup Plan was in This Is Hell too. So like a lot of the proto This Is Hell bands, along with Crime and Stereo, who has been around for a while. And so those three bands, along with a bunch of other local bands, that was the era that, so like your 99s, 2000, 2001, that was like the sweet spot for me starting to go to local shows. And I got into hardcore specifically through going to local shows rather than like going into New York City or something like that.
So yeah, you're going to local shows. It's 99, 2000, 2001. You're what, 14, 15, 16, 17, like we are. What stood out to you from the local scene that you saw then?
Yeah, I mean, I thought the shows were like nuts, obviously. But at that time, they weren't like super violent or anything like that. I kind of missed. It was like that interim period. Like, Long Island never really had, maybe like way back in the day, but it never was known for like a really violent scene, particularly with what was going on the other side of the coin, which was like also at that time, you know, brand new, Taking Back Sunday, all that yep. too was happening. But for hardcore, it was still kind of like crazy. I mean, it was the energy for me, and I really got into it through like the music, and as in like the literal music. Like, I played the drums. All I wanted to do was like play in a band. So I loved that aspect of it. And like Rick from Subterfuge, who, you know, is now a great friend of mine, like, I always thought he was such a sick drummer growing up. So I used to watch him play at local shows. And I loved the energy of it. It just kind of like clicked for me as soon as I started to go to local shows. It just made sense to me.
What I can't, like, there's not even a lot of videos out there, but like, I can't picture Glassjaw as a local band in that era. Just like, thinking about the whole context of how big they got and Ozfest and the Warped Tours and all that, did you see them like in pre-2000?
I don't think I saw them pre-2000. I want to say the first time I saw them was probably like 2001 or something like that, like kind of after they already got pretty big. In other words, I don't think I saw them before the first LP came out. Part of the reason of that is it's like when the internet is still like somewhat nascent, it exists obviously, but like, right. I didn't know what the hell was going on. I used to go to this place called None of the Above Records, and me and I had like two friends that were into hardcore. That's it. And we would go to the record store and we would find out about shows through maybe like the message board at the time. But a lot of it, I just remember being sort of like blissfully ignorant. You just like, because there was no social media. It's not like I didn't have the like group of friends that I feel like a lot of young kids do that have that now, which is so sick, obviously. I had, like I said, one or two friends that was into hardcore. That's it. And the funny thing is, looking back on it now, a lot of the friends that I have now, I remember them at shows 20 years ago, but I wasn't going to be like, hey, Brendan Garreau, nice to meet you. You know, like wasn't going to randomly introduce myself. But I can think of like people in my head right now that I remember legit 20 years ago. And I was like, I remember you at every show. I remember you at every show. And now like we're friends or acquaintances or whatever. So I feel like there was that aspect of just like not knowing what was going on. Also in, you know, before I was like, I think I got my first car when I was like 18. So like I was at the mercy of my parents driving me or whatever sketchy learner permit for, you know, my friend had. So there was a lot of that, but that era was a lot of bands who were all playing sort of distinct styles of hardcore, which I feel like came back a little bit on Long Island, which is awesome, like totally different, but everyone was all into each other's bands and even sometimes playing in each other's bands, right? So like The Movie Life and like Neglect and Glassjaw, they sound like nothing alike, but it was all just kind of like the same scene and the same people, which I think is particularly awesome. Just like that difference in sound between bands.
Well, it's cool. There were so many people that were that kind of interchangeable to different styles and wanted to play different with different people and play different music. So how did that come about for you? How did you start playing? You started with drums, you said, but you just find a couple friends and just start jamming?
Yeah. I mean, I played drums like on my, like the drum set at, you know, in my basement or whatever. And then I played in high school band, junior high band, all that. And then my first band was with kids who I went to high school with, one who was like my friend Jared, who, you know, went on to sing in Up the Fury and some other stuff. And he was kind of like my only friend into hardcore at my school. And then there were some kids a grade younger for me, and we started kind of like a bad punk band, which was my first band, which was super fun. And we played like house parties and playing on the back deck of places and shit like that. So that was like my first foray into like playing in bands, which was, you know, in high school.
I was going to say, it's funny you bring up the analog side of things. Like there was no internet really, you know? So finding new music was like, the way you were bringing it up, it's like, I remember discovering bands on people's sweatshirt in detention or study hall or something, being like, what is that? And you kind of investigate a little bit. You see it on a newspaper flyer or something, like all the old school ways of, you know, medium and promoting music, and you start to like be introduced in this weird by chance way. Sounds like it was the same exact situation for you.
Yeah, I just like there is like a simplicity to a lot of that, right? Like where you can now you can be an expert in everything, right? Like we could all become experts in in Finnish punk and D beat like tomorrow. Like we could all figure out everything. We could listen to everything. And there was something nice about that. Like I always talk about the way that I got into Strife was the ultimate poser move. I bought a Strife shirt. I had never heard the band in my life. And they had a sick live shot on the back. I was probably in like seventh or eighth grade. And it was just one of those killer live shots from like one of their crazy California shows. And I was like, that is awesome.
Which was it? One Truth or which one?
It was it was like the One Truth, like the live shot back with like the Japanese characters on it. Nice. I had it for a while. That was like, and then like it just got like completely fucked up. But I bought that. And even in my young age, I remember being like, this is a kind of poser move. Like I should probably listen to this band. And I bought the CD at the Virgin Megastore. I actually completely remember this, at the Virgin Megastore in New York City with my mom and my sister. We were in there for some reason. And I remember listening to it and being like, oh shit, this is like super intense. Like the guy's screaming his nuts off. And then, and that's kind of like how it started. But again, I just bought the shirt. Like obviously everyone talked to death about like the liner notes of it all, but that's true. That's what I would do. I would try to download the liner notes or buy the liner notes from the Strife records. I would go into None of the Above records and legitimately just buy albums that looked cool where I had never heard. I bought the Indecision split. I think I maybe had heard of them, but I was like, this is cool. And I just bought it. Never heard it in my entire life. So that aspect of things was, you know, I look back fondly on that. I'm glad I had that as an experience.
You were mentioning how like disconnected you were back then. Like, again, context is key, where there's like the internet's not what it is today. Up in Portland, Maine, we had a weekly, I guess like an arts and entertainment newspaper called The Phoenix. And it was in Boston too. And I remember going, and Tone, we used to do this, every week you'd go to our local record store and you'd get that newspaper to see who was coming local. And while you were kind of going on, I was smiling to myself, like, you'd get the show announcements, but that wasn't necessarily who was going to be at the show from a band perspective. You know what I mean? It's like, you show up and like half the bands that they said that were going to be there showed up. So it was like,
it'd just be totally different.
Be totally different. And it wasn't like you could check their IG and knew their van broke down. It's like, I already have a ticket. I'm going to go, but I don't know who the fuck is playing, you know?
Or even like at the show when they're playing through some shitty house PA and they're like, where's blah, blah, blah. And you're like, I have no idea what band that was. I just watched them for a half hour. Like I still, you know what I mean? Like I can think of so many times I'm like, don't know who that was, but yeah.
In a lot of ways, I miss that too, you know?
Yeah. Well, we romanticize about it and we've done it ad nauseum on this podcast, how we're happy we grew up in that time. I think Nate has said that no less than 10 times on this pod, because we've been able to have both, right? We've been able to have that organic, a friend told you about it. You saw the your buddy's sweatshirt in detention. You went to the record store and picked up a cool looking CD. And now we can have everything at our fingertips. So being able to live in both of those worlds has been kind of cool. I'm happy that I got to do both. I know that.
Yeah. So. You know, the other thing is too, like, I don't know how this was for you guys. And maybe this was just like, this could have been just me, but there were no concept of like, I didn't have friends in other schools. Like if you didn't go to Smithtown High School, I didn't know you. And I know now, like, you can meet people from all over and people are friends from like across the country, across the world through hardcore. I just didn't feel like it was like that. I would go to shows with my, at first one friend, then it grew into like, we had like a group of like four people, but they went to my high school and we didn't really like mingle with other people. We would show up, go to the gig, and then like get Wendy's and go home. Like, that's it. We didn't, there was, I actually really now, and especially after being in the band, but like the social aspect has become so much more for me. It wasn't like that when I was a kid at all. Outside of a couple of friends, which is one thing that's not as good. I think the social element now is really, really cool. I would have loved to have 30 people growing up that I knew, but that was not the case for me.
We were fortunate that there were a couple of local high schools close to us, one being private, just maybe 6 miles away from where we grew up. So we had friends that went to that school that lived in our town. So we'd be friends with some of those kids through that situation, but that was about it. Other than that, like, I didn't know anybody in the neighboring towns around us from those high schools until after I graduated. So yeah, we didn't, you maybe see them places, but you didn't do anything with them until we turned 22, 3, 4.
Exactly. Exactly. I just, that's funny. I kind of like noticing it now as I'm talking about it.
But we lucked out. Like the three of us have known each other, Tone and I, for 25 years.
Yeah,
Nate and I for 20. Like, we lucked out. Like, you know, without you guys, I probably wouldn't have maybe found music. Cause I remember, you know, going to shows 14, 15, 16, you know, at like the State Theater in Portland and things like that, the Asylum.
I did. I mean, I eventually, all of those people that I'm referring to, I'm friends with to this day, which is pretty cool. So, you know, my core group of friends, that guy Jared, my friend Gary, who went on to play in Diamond Stereo, he was from Smithtown and the same age as me. And that core group of friends, you know, I'm still friendly with. I was more into, at the time, was more into like the hardcore side of things. Then I had other friends from school who were way more into the Taking Back Sunday brand new side of things, which I was to an extent. But now, like, you know, all of those people have become like lifelong friends, which is pretty cool.
All right, we want to take it forward. So that was like mid-90s. Move on a couple of years later, 97, 98. You get the movie life starting in that era. And then we kind of talked about this, but VOD takes that leap, as you mentioned, and is on Ozfest, which to me, knowing the full context, it's, I don't know if it's odd, but like bands that have taken that leap typically doesn't work, like Earth Crisis, you know what I mean? Like that, it just doesn't, I mean, Hatebreed did it seamlessly. So this, it sounds like this was your kind of intro, this era maybe?
Yeah, this is right around when I was starting. I mean, again, VOD, I got into a little bit later. They weren't really like a seminal band for me at the time necessarily. It was, and at that time, it was Silent Majority was the king. Like that's their pinnacle. I believe their last show was in 2000 or 2001 or 2002.
I just watched the video on YouTube, by the way.
Okay. Yeah. 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 There was just the anniversary of it. It was like this huge snowstorm. It was 2000 or 2001, I think. And so they were just like on top of the world at that time. And then that, and yeah. And after VOD kind of blew up, the next round of bands to kind of blow up was Glassjaw and the Movie Life. And Silent Majority never really took hold outside of Long Island. They did tour. They toured with Indecision. They did a full US with Indecision. And I think they did a few other things. I know they toured with Milhouse, but they just never really popped like some of the other bands did as far as commercial success. I think they're probably the best band from Long Island ever, if not top two or three. I just think they're criminally, criminally underrated. And they're more popular probably now when they had their reunions. You had people coming in from all over, which I think is cool. So that's just, again, like the internet picking up some stuff. And the cream kind of rises to the top because at that time it just didn't work out. But yeah, that was that second wave I really think of that time, like post-VOD as far as commercial success or getting bigger. For me, Glassjaw, Movie Life, and then just how insanely huge Taking Back Sunday and Movie Life got. I mean, Taking Back Sunday and Brand New, sorry.
We felt the Taking Back Sunday and Brand New stuff in our region. I mean, they were all over the radio, especially TBS. I want to say they came through. I know they've come through since because I've seen them both in Portland, but I feel like they came through a bunch that time too. And, you know, just something that you could feel being a moment was that Long Island, those two bands coming out of Long Island. And weren't they kind of were born together, weren't they?
Yeah,
Nolan and Jesse were together.
Yeah, well, Taking Back Sunday had a singer before Adam, and they would like play locally, and then they just like blew up like it insane. Even Brand New, like just how fast they got popular was just unbelievable. Mm. I wasn't super into Brand New's first record at the time. And I liked Taking Back Sunday. I was also like a little too cool. Like I felt I was like, this is lame, like kind of. Because I was actually super into emo, but I liked the era before that. Like your Get Up Kids, Braid, Promise Ring, all that stuff was like what I was really, really into. But yeah, I just like a truly meteoric rise. And all those dudes were either coming from hardcore or hardcore adjacent or something. So that was definitely like a big deal on Long Island. Maybe to like outside people, those worlds seem totally separate, but they weren't at all. I mean, Eddie Reyes, who was in Taking Back Sunday, was in the Movie Life and all these other bands. And so it was an inside, I think, was he playing Glassjaw for a little bit maybe? I'm not sure, but like, you know, although it was kind of that incestuous type of scene. So yeah, that was a pretty crazy time.
It's crazy. The scene just like, I feel like it came out of nowhere basically. And we're from Maine, like Tone just mentioned. So, you know, it came, we saw it on the Warped Tour and everything that came through Maine. Our Warped Tour wasn't in Maine, but you know what I mean? Like headline shows and stuff like that. You said earlier, like a lot of the friends that you had known one removed at concerts and stuff like that. Was it the same for these bands? Like you knew someone that was, you know, one person removed from Taking Back Sunday, something like that?
Yeah. Well, particularly now, right? Like, yeah. I mean, I just like for staying involved in music so long, I don't know the Brand New guys. I've talked to Eddie from Taking Back Sunday, and like I've heard, you know, I we are all kind of related in some way, like one or two degrees of separation. But at that time for us, we kind of, a lot of those bands, I should also mention, were from Nassau County, and it's ridiculous that that matters, but like Nassau and Suffolk, I'm from Suffolk, which is farther out east, and kind of felt like they had their own thing going on. And for me, the era of Subterfuge, which was just like a huge influence on me, not as popular, obviously, but Subterfuge and the Backup Plan, now you're getting into like 99, 2000, 2001. That, for me personally, that was my era, and Crime and Stereo, and kind of like leading up into This Is Hell, which went on to become huge. I know we're like jumping ahead a little bit, but that was really for me where I met most of my friends, to your point, like outside of just my little insular group.
Tuan, super excited. You mentioned Crime and Stereo. I know it's coming. So.
I'm a fanboy. I mean, we'll get into it. Yeah.
You turned us onto him too. I mean, I remember you riding for the Troubled Stateside to me about 15 years ago. Like, dude, you got to listen to this. Like,
dude, and that's the sad, well, not a sad reality, but the reality of it, it was 15 years ago. 06,
yeah, right.
Which is bananas.
Insane. It's insane.
But so you mentioned something interesting, which is like they were from one county and the other, and the lyrics, and actually it's a lot of the Crime and Stereo lyrics, are they paint Long Island as a small town, yet geographically it's 100 miles long, you know, 20 miles wide at its like widest or whatever. And it seems like it's one of those places that like you're happy to have grown up from, but not necessarily, and don't take this as a diss, but not necessarily happy about maybe living there as an adult. Like, it's just an interesting, and that's part of the intrigue, which is like, you know, as a Mainer, you know, you hear all this and you think it's like the small island, but like, how was that? Did that like add to the effect of like, you're able to go to all the shows because it's close proximity or?
Yeah, I mean, listen, the thing about Long Island is it's so populous. I think it would be something like the 11th or 7th biggest state or some crazy statistic. Yeah. If it was on its own. It's huge. I mean, geographically, yeah, but in terms of population. Right. And so you have a collection of people who are like, their parents all moved out to the burbs from New York City, like my parents and countless others. And then you're all just part of these true suburbia type areas. Like Long Island is where suburbia started. The term Levitt towns, you know, post-World War II, there's a town in Long Island called Levittown.
Oh, right.
Like that's where Crime and Stereo is from. So like that like community aspect is, you just had a ton of people moving out, not to get all like geographical and historical, but like you had a bunch of people move out to the burbs post-World War II, and you just had this population boom, right? And so that's where you just see like it was a ton of young people. It was a great place to grow up, and it just birthed, I think, a lot of great music from the sheer amount of people on the island. And I think that's also why you saw kind of like a decline in maybe like as many newer New York hardcore bands, and seeing that shift more to Long Island, because really just for the geographical reasons and like socioeconomic reasons, you had those families getting pushed out and priced out of New York City and moved to the burbs, and the middle class kind of grew on Long Island and just created, you know, an incredible population in terms of size.
I've never thought of it that way. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that is the case. Like it's a packed ass area, especially when you drive around. Like it is, I should know this, but it's several million people on an area, you know, not that big.
I think it's seven.
Yeah, that's crazy. I mean, the other aspect is it's geographically sort of isolated. And by that, I mean, it's a huge pain in the ass to get off Long Island because you have to go through New York City. And so you get a lot of people who don't really leave, right? And it just kind of creates a little culture. It's certainly its own place, that's for sure. For better or for worse.
I was just going to say that it's like a little microcosm of its own creative energy and all this amazing music that came out of it. I mean, it's like there's something in the water, right? Like New York has the best pizza. So you guys are condensed in Long Island. And just like you got the pop punk, you got the metal, you got the hardcore.
Yeah.
All coming out of the same area. It's amazing.
You also had a good string of luck with venues, right? Like that aspect is so huge, because like honestly you can have the best like talent and everything, but if you don't have a place for younger kids to play, you're kicked, right? And that the VFW hall style scene just happened to be successful on Long Island. There were a lot of venues, I mean, always changing, but there were a lot of venues that were able to have shows. And I think we got really lucky with that, right? Like you go to some places where it's like, it's the whatever theater and it's drinking, you know, it's 21 plus and it's hard to get into shows if you're underage and blah, blah, blah. Like that is the death knell for a music scene, particularly mm-hmm. this kind. But if you can have all ages shows, that's going to actually like birth and start a scene. And that's a huge aspect of it, at least in my opinion.
Well, you want that 15, 16 year old to go to that show because it's inspiration for them to do something 6 years from now or 10 years from now even. So that, I mean, we did that and turned it into this. We, none of us were so musically inclined to turn it into a band, but I mean, there's inspiration there for us too. And that makes complete sense to me. You need those places. They need the small places to get and have all those, you know, young kids in there to find their inspiration to do something like that.
Yeah. I mean, a band is just like one element of it, right? Like just everything else going on. You probably could plot like the success of Long Island or any other location with the availability of all ages venues, right? Like when you had golden area, that era that you guys are talking about, a VOD and the 2,500 people, kids coming, I was at an all ages venue called PWAC, this warehouse, right? And then you had in the early to mid 2000s, you had this free space sort of like collective, which was a super cool, you know, DIY spot that had like a lot more like activism. That I remember a lot more tables there, the whole Food Not Bombs sort of presence. And so a lot of that was happening. And now we have Amityville Music Hall, which is a bar, but the owners are all sort of come from this world and do all ages shows and stuff. So it's virtually impossible to have a good scene without that, again, of this kind of music.
Yeah, I agree. And to be honest, we're all from, you know, the Northeast, so we can kind of relate with the fact that in the winter, there's really not much you can do to like ski or see all ages shows. So, you know, without that scene, without that place to go, you know, I live here in San Diego, and Jeff Ament, bassist from Pearl Jam, he, when he's not touring, he's putting together skate parks all through the country just so kids have something to do, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So going to shows is like a release, you know, like what else are you going to do? Sitting home, you know, sit home, it's snowing out. So all ages shows was like, you know, clearly all of us like a vice.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are these, you can tie them to these iconic venues like Che Cafe. You had the Cave in Bucksport, which I think is in the middle of nowhere, but it's still.
Cave,
yeah, of course, man. Yeah.
Nice.
And like all these, right? Like you had all that stuff. You had all, you had Anchors Up, which was, I mean, birthed an entire scene from just that place. I maybe it's just from being to a lot of different venues and stuff, but that is, again, just like a really, I think, interesting and important part of it.
Is there also this element that because a show's on quote unquote Long Island, and I say island in quotes, that everything's like accessible? And I'll use the Cave for an example. The Cave's 3 hours away from Portland, but because it's in Maine, I used to go all the time, but I would never think about going that distance south to Rhode Island. So is there that element? Like if you're on the other side of Long Island, if there's a show on Long Island, no matter where it is, I'm there, which if it was in the same distance in the other direction, you maybe wouldn't go because it's off the island.
100%. I mean, like, I know people did travel and I occasionally went, but like, dude, I wouldn't go see the Beatles reunite if it was like in Jersey. So I'm gonna be like, I'm all set. Don't feel like driving through the city. Like, that is a huge aspect of it. And I actually think like what was interesting is New York City is New York City, but a lot of bands over the years, as Long Island became like a thing, were purposely coming to Long Island instead of New York City because it was that good, right? And like even with hardcore bands, Brooklyn kind of had its own thing and started to crush it, but not that long ago, if it were a hardcore band, let's just keep it to hardcore, like you'd be out of your mind to play in New York City. You'd come to Long Island, like you know it's going to be way better. And so that is something that is similar to other places too. Like you got to go to where the kids are, right? Like a lot of shows in proper cities suck. You got to go somewhere a couple minutes outside, right? Like the difference was playing in downtown LA rather than playing in Chain Reaction or something like that. Like, so that is an aspect in that, yeah, you're in this insular, geographically isolated area, and it's, but bands knew that they could come here and get a really good turnout, and they did, you know, a lot of bands.
This sounds to me like I wish you had been marketing for Portland, Maine 20 years ago, because we could have used you saying, yeah, you know, Boston's great, but go up to Portland, they don't get it, and they need it, and they want it, and they will turn out for you.
Yeah, I mean, but it's a population thing, right? You can, totally. You're showing up to Long Island, and yeah, it's like you're having 400 kids roll out of the woodwork of the picket fence community.
And there's no Spotify metrics to see where the listeners are, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's trial and error.
I'm saying back then.
Yeah, it's just trial and error, man.
That's a good point with the venue thing. I lived in Greenpoint, Brooklyn for a little while.
That's where I lived for many, many years.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I just moved out of there in October.
Oh, wow. The Greenpoint. And then I was up in Upper West Side in Harlem. And you're right. Like, it was hard to get to metal shows in the city. It's usually like some outskirt of the city. For whatever reason, I've always found that weird because there was a huge metal community in the city.
Yep.
So it was bizarre.
Yeah, New York is, I mean, Brooklyn just became its own thing. And, you know, with metal and stuff, and I live down the block from St. Vitus, and like all those guys are my homies. Also,
sweet.
All the people who own that are Long Island hardcore guys, which is cool. But, you know, Brooklyn, it was the kind of place where you'd get random metal acts who could fly there and play to 700 people and wouldn't be able to draw 50 anywhere else in the country, maybe outside of LA or something like Austin. So I benefited a lot from having that amazing venue down the block for me, for sure.
Were you going to Club Europa and Warsaw Theater and stuff like that?
Yeah. We played Europa before it closed. That place kind of sucked. Warsaw is cool. Brian from Incendiary lives across the street from it, actually. So yeah, there are a ton of great venues there. Vitus for me was like the spot. I just saw so many great venues and a perfect example of like a hardcore style venue. So I can't say enough good things about that place.
Yeah. I miss Greenpoint. That's a great spot, man.
All right. So we hit the kind of late 90s. So into 99, 2000, we kind of touched upon this a little bit, but brand new Taking Back Sunday blow up. And at least with like Taking Back Sunday, I don't even think like I ever heard anything before that victory. Tell All Your Friends. Like, I don't remember a demo. Like, I think if you go back on YouTube, he wasn't the original singer. Is that what happened there? Adam?
Yeah. Adam, the original singer was this dude named Antonio, and Adam played bass for Taking Back Sunday. And then Adam moved to vocals, and then they had music out before Tell All Your Friends, and I want to say they had like a demo or something. And then, but that record came out and they just completely blew up. Yeah.
I'm curious how Victory even sniffed them out. Like, because like the Long Island sound wasn't that, it wasn't like they were poaching Long Island per se.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is though, like, I don't know if Long Island has a sound. Like, I think that's the eclectic nature of the bands is like what makes it sound in a lot of ways. Cause like I can think of other bands. I mean, to be clear, like Taking Back Sunday on Brand New are on such another level from all these other bands. It's not even fun. I mean, Brand New sold literally millions of records. Like they played Madison Square Garden. Like, so they're on a complete other level. But like, yeah, I mean, all these other bands, like they're different. And that's, you know, Kill Your Idols sounds like nothing like Silent Majority, who sounds nothing like Antirabe, like the whole like metalcore scene at the time, or A Love for Enemies, which was like a Christian metalcore band. And all of these bands would honestly really play together. And I think that's the cool part. I mean, there was a general emo scene, I think, but Brand New and Taking Back Sunday don't sound anything alike, you know? As far as how Taking Back Sunday got discovered, that's a great question. I just feel like some of that stuff happened straight up overnight, dude. That's at least what it felt like at the time. It was like Brand New playing some bowling alley and then, you know, going on tour and then playing to like at the downtown to like whatever, and then playing at the like other venues to 1,000 people. Like, it just was like,
it's crazy.
Insane. Yeah.
You mentioned something that hit me, because we've talked about this before in the past with other guests. Chad from This Seems Forever and Strong Arm, mixed bills. So you're right. In that area, you must be seeing a ton of mixed bills with different sounds from band to band in the same show.
Tons. Yeah, that went away for a little bit. When I first started to go to shows, hugely, hugely different. Yeah, well, I mean, like, all kinds of stuff, from melodic hardcore to, you know, George from Mind Over Matter at a band called Earthling Massive, which played a lot of local shows, and that was almost like electronic, almost industrial. Wow. And then, like, a mosh band would play, you know what I mean? So, like, it really was like that, which was really nice. And because I was like that, I kind of have like an ADD style of music listening too, so I guess that fit me. Things became a little more genre-fied, and now I feel like it's coming back, and it's okay again to have, you know, mixed bills. Like, we just played some festival a year or two ago, and it was like we played back to back with Turnover, you know what I mean? Like, nice. that's cool. And so that reminds me of growing up.
Well, and the shared members. Like, that's, you know, one guy could show up and play in all three bands, you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. Totally. I mean, like, you know, Chris Smith from from Backtrack is like in King Nine now, which is like the hardest of the hard. And then, like, he's playing in I Am the Avalanche too, which is
that
is like the best part of that, is just like, it's all the same people just playing different things and like helping each other out in terms of filling in. Like, so many people have filled in for Incendiary over the years from different bands and stuff too, which is really cool.
Mixed bill thing so funny, because it was kind of our same ebb and flow growing up of like, oh, if you weren't goth, you don't listen to Marilyn Manson, you know? And then you realize, like, oh shit, Marilyn Manson's actually really good. You know, we were all in the kind of like that fitting the narrative at the time. Like, no, if you're not goth, you don't listen to that stuff. And you realize later, like, shit, I missed out on all this amazing stuff.
Yeah.
Dude, it's very weird that you said that, because literally today, I don't even remember why I was thinking about this. I think I was listening to a podcast and someone was talking about nu metal, but I remember I was thinking about all the like goth kids in high school that I like wasn't friends with, or was, you know, like that wasn't really my group of friends. I rode BMX. It was into like skating. And like I said, like hardcore and Pennywise and shit like that, like Rancid, blah, blah, blah. But looking back on it, I'm like, I bet some of those dudes were listening to some cool, hard shit. And I just like would have probably been friends with them, but it was like totally different. And partly because, like, at the time, Slipknot was so huge, and I just, like, think Slipknot sucks and I've never liked them. So I just – that was, like, they were so big. I mean, we're all the same age. They were – I'm sure for you guys, they were massive when that first came out, and everybody loved them. And I was like, this is whack. But
you just described our cafeteria in 2000. It's the same thing.
I mean, I always thought the drummer was absolutely incredible. So from drums, like, I was like, this is cool. But I just, like – we gave it its fair shot. Me and Brian from Incendiary, like, our drummer, like, digs the first record. And, like, we remember in the van being like, I'm going to try to give this a shot. Like, hit me with it. Give me your best. And I was like, nah, this sucks.
So, Brendan, we all ride very hard for Slipknot.
We
do. Do you?
Yeah.
Honestly, I'm sorry, okay, man, with it. No, I'm okay with
shame.
This. Like, that's the best part about this podcast, is I am perfectly fine with hearing another person's point of view about it.
Yeah, it doesn't do it for me. I don't like to use the word suck unless a band actually sucks. They obviously don't suck.
Yeah, I got you.
I just don't find it that heavy. Yeah. It's like, I don't know what it is. That dude, Joey Jordison, like, his drumming is legit sick, but I never thought it was heavy. It was a little too like evil. My parents don't like me. Like, it was a little too much like that. But I can get into all kinds of shit, man. Like, I mean, I fucked with the first Limp Bizkit out record. I loved Korn. Loved that shit. But they didn't do it for me. I don't know why. Maybe I was acting too cool, man. Like, to your point, Nate, maybe it was too clicky for me. Maybe I should have just embraced it with open arms at the time.
Yeah. You can go back in retrospect. It would have been a whole different thing. Would have gotten a whole lot, you know, a lot of more shows, all sorts of things, but whatever.
Changed my life, dude.
It's
for better or for worse.
Yeah.
You're talking about that time frame and seeing those, you know, that group of people that maybe you weren't friends with because you were into other things. And then after the fact being like, I like that music, shit, like, I should have talked to them. Who knows? Whatever. This was me with Slipknot. Nate got me into them late. Like, when did we see them, Nate? About 10 years ago in outside of Boston.
Yeah.
And I washed the ticket and destroyed it and had to get another one from our buddy at the radio station. But yeah, I wasn't into it either. And then I saw him live and I was like, okay, I get it now. Like, this works for me.
Yeah. You know, I could see standing in Madison Square Garden after drinking a couple beers, yeah, seeing that live, being like, all right, this is pretty fucking awesome.
That was me.
Yeah, I could 100% see that for sure. Man, listen, man, you guys are making me feel bad. Maybe I'll give it another.
No. You've got an opinion. You're entitled to that opinion. We're cool with that.
I mean, God bless them. They're the biggest metal band in the world. So
no harm, no foul. We had Ian Robinson from former MTV BJ on here. Yeah. And he was like shitting on Pearl Jam nonstop. I'm like, it's
band. Like Nate's favorite band. One of favorite bands. Oh.
Yeah, no, I'm a Pearl Jam guy. Sorry. I love that. Nice.
So yeah, we're cool.
The Slipknot Roadrunner thing is a good transition, because in 2000, Glassjaw drops, what was it, Everything You Ever Want to Know About Silence, which in the context of their career, like knowing where they came from, Long Island hardcore scene, like that's weird to me. So I don't know, was that a big thing on the island? Like, holy shit, like Glassjaw just signed a Roadrunner. And maybe Roadrunner wasn't what they are now back then. I don't know.
I would say the opposite. Roadrunner back then was just a titan, just huge. Yeah, I think it was kind of like, holy shit.
Yeah.
And I also think that Glassjaw got unduly lumped into nu metal when they absolutely weren't. I can tell you guys that, like, Justin Beck, who plays guitar in that band, is disgustingly talented. Just there, he's an unbelievable musician, unbelievable guitar player. Unbelievable drummer, actually, too.
Oh, wow.
And they it was weird how they kind of got lumped in. I think partly because of some of their touring, and a big reason because of being on Roadrunner. But they were always, I mean, sonically, I really never thought that they were, you know, lumped in with that, or should have been lumped into that stuff at all.
No, they didn't. They didn't fit that at all.
No.
It's probably the time that they blew up. I mean, that time of, in history for music, everybody was new metal adjacent if they weren't new metal, and Deftones, and they're not a new metal band. I mean, they came up around then, but they've done enough different stuff. So
they have.
I think that was just the time.
But to your point, they get lumped in with new metal to this day.
All the time, yeah.
Yeah, and I think you see these trends with, like, it makes me think of like post-hardcore, right? With like, you have like Quicksand getting, you know, popular, and then Walter does Rival Schools, and then all these other, that style of like the hardcore band turn alterna college rock post-hardcore. And then you had the same thing with emo. You have Taking Back Sunday and Brand New blowing up, and then these other bands that were kind of like second tier that were kind of trying to make it to and get pulled up into it, and then they all just get lumped into this one thing, and it's like this whirlwind, and it's usually stemming from some kind of like major label interest. Yep. Oh, right. Yeah. That like sucks.
We've
everything
talked about
up
this a lot. Just like, just the feeding frenzy. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. 100%. Yep.
Yeah. I was just going to say with Roadrunner, I mean, they had Nickelback. That doesn't fit that vein of, you know, new metal. Right. But they're, you know, multi-platinum band. So obviously they saw the money signs. They're like, oh, whatever, we'll take them.
Yeah. I mean, so, and Nickelback and Slipknot are the way that these bands can go out and sign all these other bands. Cause it's the cash cow. It's like, it's basically like being an angel investor. That's what it is. You sign a million things, you invest in 100 companies, and then if you hit it big on one, it pays the returns back for the 99 others that didn't.
So what you're saying is we should be thanking Nickelback for all those other bands that we love on Roadrunner. I love
that. Exactly.
That's
right.
Great. That's
exactly.
Great.
Thank you, Chad. We appreciate it.
Thank them for the Madball signing.
You know what I heard about Nickelback? That they were like a Road Dogs I don't know about Road Dogs, but were like sort of toiling in obscurity for a really long time before they got popular, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Could see that. Hey,
more power to them, man. If you can play music for a living, God
bless
you.
They kept going. Yeah. And then they blew up, obviously. I mean, they've made millions of dollars playing music over the years. Yeah. So
they're laughing all the way to the bank, is for sure. Yep.
Well, the thing about Glassjaw too, is like the imagery of that CD was in line with nu metal, you know?
It was, yeah.
It wasn't like, you know, a photo of like gang sing-alongs. It was a very nu metal feeling visual, which I'm sure helped. And then it could have been label pressure to have them fit in. It's actually very similar to like the Finch cover. Do you remember them?
Mm-hmm. It looks exactly like the Finch cover. Yeah. I thought the same thing when I went back to listen to that and I was like, yep, this looks like the Finch cover.
I'm pretty sure Finch was, shall we say, heavily influenced by Glassjaw.
Yeah.
Yeah. And didn't Daryl sing on the record?
On two of the songs. Yeah. Yeah.
Project Mayhem and something else. Yeah. Yeah.
Finch is like glass jaw light. Diet glass jaw. Yeah.
They pretty much were. You're right. And I love that Finch record junior year of high school. But and it's funny, I didn't get into glass jaw till after that. And it's like, I guess I graduated to it.
And Finch was Deftones light in the early days.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. True. Yeah, I almost think there's an East Coast, West Coast, you know, with the labels, like maybe there's no rhyme or reason to it, but they need someone to basically rival the West Coast emo scene. So they sign Taking Back Sunday out of the blue, maybe. I mean, they probably saw something, but they were like, you know, this is the Nets, or this is the Lakers versus the Celtics. We need our, you know, our head honcho team to combat the West Coast or something. I don't know.
I mean, Victory was no one trick pony. Like they wasn't just Taking Back Sunday. They signed Thursday. They had that Hawthorne Heights band that had that song. They signed Bayside, who I love and are friends of ours. They were just dominant in that space, and they marketed the shit out of it and were super aggressive. And I, you know, I think a lot of those bands kind of got put through the ringer a little bit of that whole thing, which is, you know, unfortunate.
So in that era, so now we're in the early 2000s, obviously at that point in time, TBS brand new. I don't know if they're at the peak of their powers, but they're almost at the tipping point of like their peak fame. You know, the early 2000s, Dejan Tandu comes out in 03. But then you have probably my favorite band ever, Crime and Stereoforms, early 2000s. And for me, it's interesting, Brendan, you say that Long Island doesn't have a sound, but to me, they're like the fusion of Silent Majority. You hear some of that in there. Movie Life, you hear that in there. Kill Your Idols. In fact, if you're listening to this podcast right now, pause it right now. Listen to the intro to Bicycles for Afghanistan by Crime and Stereo, and then listen to the song 10 Seconds Too Late by The Movie Life. It's the same exact intro. It's uncanny. And I look at it as a tribute. Like, I don't look at it as a copycat. I look at it as like, we're from the same region. We probably grew up on this. But so yeah, Crime and Stereo, were they a big deal coming up? I mean, I assume yes.
Totally. Yeah. You know what? I do hear what you're saying, dude. I think in terms of sound, I would also throw out Tommy Corrigan from Silent Majority as hugely influential on Long Island sound. I think Daryl from Glassjaw took a lot from Tommy. And, you know, for Crime and Stereo, I mean, Alex from Crime and Stereo played in, I think it was called The Rookie Lot with the guys from Brand New, right? Yeah, so Alex is super talented. Yeah, Crime and Stereo, I became really close with them because I was saying, like, one of my best friends from high school joined that band. When did he join? God, maybe like 2006 or 2007.
Is it Gary?
Yeah.
He was like 06, 07. Yeah.
Is that right? Okay. Yeah. I remember. I was the one who was like, you should try out for these guys. They're fucking awesome. But yeah, they were like kind of a straightforward hardcore band, really started to do well and was touring a lot and was, you know, catching on really well. They did really well in California and then kind of put out like that Troubled Stateside, which is sort of their seminal record. And then they got even bigger for a while, right? Like they were really crushing it. They toured with Newfound Glory. They toured Australia with Against Me. Actually, Matt from Incendiary, our bass player, was in Crime and Stereo for a while too.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, they just became really close friends to us. And they were, to your kind of apt point, they were the next band kind of carrying the torch in that interim period. I would say Crime and Stereo and This Is Hell of that post, I guess you call it post-Silent Majority, was like really like the torchbearers for a while. And I love them. I also should say that like I think Crime and Stereo's later albums are also amazing. Mm-hmm. All of them, even to Is Dead and the one after that, I think are great. Can't say enough great things about them.
Brendan, one thing we were wondering, these bands, like as they get bigger, do they kind of lose their identity, the Long Island identity at all? Or is the local feeling kind of lost once they get to that status, or?
Do you mean like how they're recepted by Long Island?
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say almost all the bands still were able to maintain their fan base on Long Island still. I think as long as you showed them love, right? I think for bands who just disappear and tour the world and never come back, you know, it can be a little bit whatever, but No, Long Island was pretty good in terms of holding it down for their own. And that was something that's like, I've been very mindful of that, extremely mindful of that, to play Long Island enough where it's honestly kind of like, it's difficult, right? Because we've probably played, Incendiary has probably played Long Island, I don't even know, 40, 50 times or something.
Yeah.
And it's a fine line between, do I really have to shove this crap down these poor people throats who've seen us 30 times versus we come off as we're too cool to, right, to play, you know, our hometown. So yeah, I've always been really, again, like really conscious of that. And we've just been so lucky to have the support nice, from Long Island and not just Incendiary, a lot of other bands who have come from there. But that is something that I think is on a lot of bands' radars for yeah, sure. And other bands don't have that. I can think of a few bands like who did kind of lose the support of Long Island a little bit. And I could think of other bands in other towns where like, I know that their hometown is kind of like whatever. And I always thought that was kind of a shame.
No, I did get the feeling that Long Island like looked after their own. Cause like I saw Glassjaw headlining tour in 06 at the Worcester Palladium, which is like 2000 cap in, Crime and Stereo and This Is Hell were the support. So like they brought out Long Island bands. Which
yeah,
is
I went
awesome,
to that. Yep. Yeah. They, a lot of those bands were really cool about that because Glassjaw is a good example. Glassjaw was the dudes in that band were always like riding for the older Long Island bands. Glassjaw is like loves Mind Over Matter. Like, and George sings on their newest record, the singer of Mind Over Matter, who I think a lot of people from Long Island look at them as like one of the sort of progenitors of Long Island hardcore. And so there is a lot of like paying respects to that. And I think of that too, like in for all the bands that we kind of look up to. So that is definitely like a pervasive thing.
Yeah, I think it's important. I mean, it shows in the music, right? And the fans, if they don't hear the roots, they fade away. You know, it's not something they can really identify with anymore, maybe. Or the band just has distanced themselves so much, they're like a California band now all of a sudden.
Yeah. I guess I do notice that there is like this weird camaraderie, and I feel really lucky. I mean, I was kind of saying this before, like from a social perspective, that I've gotten to be friends with such an eclectic group of people that have been in all these different kinds of bands. And even just something was weird as like growing up, liking a band and then becoming friends with them later, right? Like going to see Vinny's bands and then becoming friends with them now, like it's cool, you know? And he's another dude, you know, Vinny from Movie Life and Avalanche, like who was just like a Long Island hardcore lifer, still hugely supportive of newer Long Island bands and stuff like that. So I that's something that I feel a responsibility to now that Incendiary has been a band for a long time, is just constantly trying to put on for newer Long Island bands. That's something that's important to all five of us in the band.
That's really cool that you're cognizant of the next generation coming up. You want to kind of usher them in because they need that help, right? You've been through it a little bit, so you can, like in any walk of life, experience is the best teacher. So if you can give them a little bit of love and take them out on tour when we get back to that, that's awesome. Like that's just making the scene a better place.
Yeah, we take that really seriously, honestly, man. We always have. We'll always do, you know, we did an annual like holiday charity show, and we'd always have local bands on it, always play Long Island, always put on for local Long Island bands. I feel a big responsibility to do that. And everybody in Incendiary feels the same way for sure, because that's what a lot of bands helped us out. This Is Hell helped Incendiary out a lot. Crime and Stereo helped Incendiary out a lot. Backtrack helped Incendiary out a lot. So yeah, you know, it's a pay it forward type of thing.
So speaking of that, we kind of come to that point, you guys form. How did that come about?
Yeah, well, so interestingly enough, I mean, the years of 2002 to 2006 was, I was away in college and I was up by you guys. I went to school in New Hampshire. So like I was seeing, it was Long Island hardcore all summer. And then it was Boston and New Hampshire hardcore all fall and winter and spring. So I had like a weird dichotomy between that, because those years I was seeing so many shows in New England too. But Incendiary started because in 2006, I moved back to New York and moved to New York City. And I had been sort of like, I was playing in bands with my friends, but like always had to quit because I had to go back to school, blah, 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 blah. And so this for me was like, all right, Long Island's popping. I have all these friends here now. I've never been able to do a band because I was up in Durham, New Hampshire. Now I'm going to like start a band finally. But I was living in New York City at the time, and really all of my friends were still in Long Island. And so, you know, my friends, most of my friends from Smithtown, like I was like, I really want to do a band. Can we get something together? But I just want to sing because I don't really feel like bringing my drums to every band practice. So nice. I'm just going to try this. And here we are 14 years later or whatever. Yeah. That's kind of how it started.
That's awesome.
So in that era, were you, cause I went to school in, Northeastern Mass. It's right on the Northeastern Brockton line. Did you ever go to like the ICC shows in Alston or Cambridge Elk shows in Cambridge?
Yeah, 100%.
That we were all at the same shows. So it's kind of like what you said with growing up in Long Island. You were at these shows with all these people. You meet them years later. So that's us right now as we're talking, mm-hmm. right?
That's awesome. Yeah. No, I distinctly remember going to Skate Fest 2002 at the Worcester Palladium and seeing Hope Conspiracy and being absolutely terrified because the shows in Long Island from when I was growing up was not like that at all. Right. Like I was going to the, you know, the movie life shows weren't exactly everybody gets hurt pit. Like, so go to see the Hope Conspiracy. And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to die. Like, so I distinctly remember that, seeing how Boston hardcore shows were. So, or well, Worcester technically, but yeah, I have a lot of fond memories about that.
Did you go to Skatefest 03?
What was the year where American Nightmare played and the Transformer blew?
That must have been 02, because 03 was when Movie Life played, and right as they were going into the last song, Vinny goes, this is the last song we'll ever play. They stopped being a band before the last song. So you would have remembered if you were there.
Really?
Yeah.
And yeah, I remember, I don't think I was.
They rolled through Portland like 3 years ago, and he was at the bar, and I walked over, and I was like, dude, was that for real? He's like, yeah, we got in a big blowout before the show. And he was like, we're done.
That's fucking crazy.
Oh. Brent, with the come up, I'm just really interested. Long Island clearly shaped the sound of your music, right? Because we were 100%. Talking all this backstory on, you know, where you are and how the band came together. So who, like, what are the influences you're drawn from? I know you mentioned Pennywise earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I was when I was, you know, a kid, and my tastes like kind of evolved, although I still love Pennywise. Yeah, for Incendiary, it was going for the lane of bands that was really my high school and formative years. And a lot of my friends in Incendiary, you know, we kind of drew from the same well of influences. I would say, as far as Long Island, VOD, particularly for Rob and Brian, the guitar players, were a huge influence. Indecision musically was a big influence. I know, New York hardcore band, but you know, Tom and the gang would play Long Island a lot actually over the years. 108 was a big influence. Earth Crisis and Strife and Snapcase were big influences. That kind of heavy hardcore Victory style. And then there were, you know, just like kind of other random shit. But I would say those were the main influences, particularly to start.
Yeah, I almost feel like there's this like almost pressure, right? Like there's almost like that kind of brotherhood. And I go back to like Glassjaw taking out just Long Island bands. Like, was there any pressure for that, or you just let it ride, like just naturally?
No, I don't think so. I mean, like the thing is, man, like what I wanted to do with Incendiary, my like dream goal was, and I'm really not just saying this, was just to play shows on Long Island. Like, nice. I just wanted to be part of it again. You know, like it for me, I had a lot of FOMO, as the kids say, like away at college, and it was kind of fucking with my head, like whether I should come move back home and stuff. And I just wanted to be back into it. And I would, as far as influences go, when we started, although now it's hugely popular, even more 90s than we sound like, that was not a popular kind of music, right? Mm-hmm. 2007 was still the height of the like melodic hardcore.
Have hearts, you know, and yeah.
What's that?
Have Heart and Verse and those guys.
Yeah, yeah. And even before that, dude, though, even like With Honor and like, you know, like the Locking Out stuff, right? Like that was still popular. So like we weren't really like, that wasn't really what was going on. Like our you know, Snapcase worship. So, you know, it eventually, there was a lot of other bands doing that, which I thought was great, but that was the other thing I think maybe helped us. It kind of hurt us at first, but then eventually helped us. We were doing something a little bit different.
So you talk about FOMO, you talk about being at school in the Northeast. I wonder, how did you hold back from making a band in college? Are you getting with people there, like-minded people there, and keep that kind of flame alive for the Long Island reunion?
I did.
Yeah.
I mean,
I did. Yeah.
Yeah. I played in a band with some dudes in New Hampshire, in 2005, I guess. And then I played in like a band with some kids from Derry and Manchester also. And I was playing with some other kids. You have to remember how like logistically annoying it is to have a drum set in your dorm room,
yeah.
like carrying it, driving it up from New York. But like, no, I played quite a bit, man. And I enjoyed it too. The last band I was in was called Roid Rage, and it was a blast. And it was a bunch of shitheads, and we had a lot of fun playing like Crowbar Worship. So no, yeah, I did. And that kind of kept, that did allow me to keep like my chops up a little bit. Yeah. And then all summer, you know, I played in a band called Up to Fury and another band called Since You, which like once I had to kind of like leave that, they got new drummers and a lot of them played. Up to Fury wound up touring a lot, which is really cool. So I tried to stay in it as much as I could for sure.
Nice.
The drums on campus is no joke, because I had two separate roommates that were drummers, and it was late nights at the sports complex. Like they found a room that they could store their stuff in, and it was after hours. And you just try not to annoy people. It was,
yeah, man.
It's impossible, I mean, like, basically.
It's such a so awful instrument. It's fun to play, but it's just such a pain in the ass. Like I used to drive to Manchester, like where the old mills were, like at like 8 o'clock at night, drive all my shit there, carry it up two flights of stairs, set it up, practice, take it out, drive back home by myself, like just without a second thought. And even when Incendiary for the first 7 years of Incendiary, I was the only person who lived in New York, and I would drive an hour to Long Island after work and then an hour back. Like just, I look back on it now and it's, I just can't believe I did that, but I was just like singularly focused.
Love of the game.
Love of the game, man. That's all it is.
It makes you think about how many drummers could have been, you know, they just didn't have that. They didn't have the convenience of it. And now you think like, oh, they have the drums with like the rubber cymbals and stuff. And there's just all these prodigies on YouTube. Like, oh, well, now they can.
You know? I know. Yeah, I know. It's like, oh, you use real drums? No, you just have to get an electric kit. I know. I started trying to play the drums again after a decade long absence. And it's, I have a long way to go to get back to my form.
I would imagine that's something, that's like a muscle you've got to work out, or it goes away pretty quickly.
Yeah. You know, I'm better than the average person for sure, yeah. But like my 18-year-old self is would smoke me right now. So just try to get back on the horse.
That's age too, unfortunately for all of us.
Yeah, dude, for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So let's take it back the last decade, 2010s to the present. You got Movie Life still around. You got Glassjaw still making records. You guys are still kicking it. Backtrack calls it quits. Crime and Stereo, for lack of better words, calls it quits. Like, how would you describe the scene now? And actually, you moving back, right? You're back in Long Island.
Yep.
Well, maybe it's not a good comparison because the scene's not active because of the global conditions here. But I guess, how does it compare to like when you got into it?
Yeah.
I feel like there's less bands maybe, less bands now.
You know, I actually think it's kind of come full circle. I'll sort of preface this by like, pre-pandemic, right? Because blah blah blah, who cares about that? There's nothing going on. But it is, I do feel like it's come full circle. What I mean by that is there is actually a really strong and diverse group of bands playing, that everyone is kind of friendly and like there isn't a lot of like beef and everyone's pretty cool, right? I mean, like Backtrack breaking up sucks, but they conquered the world. I really like, I can't say enough great things about Backtrack, like just real quick. Like we started a similar time. We started a little before them, but the road dog nature of that band just went out and did so much cool shit, always rode for Long Island, and was virtually single-handedly responsible for kind of keeping a Long Island on the map for bands out of state coming to Long Island, right? Like the Down to Nothings of the world and stuff like that. So they're like our brothers, and you know, we played their last show, which was fun, but sad. So they really like left a great mark. But I think now you have like, you know, King Nine has become like a juggernaut too and are crushing it. But then you also have Sanction. Sanction is becoming really big and are touring and more on like that metalcore tip. Those kids are awesome. A lot of them are from the same town that I'm from, and I love them. You have Somerset Thrower, which is more of like a 90s style sort of like alternative post-hardcore band that are just phenomenally good. And there's a lot of other younger bands like Jab and some other things going on. There's Regulate, which is crushing it. Like there's a lot of bands kind of on their A game, and they all sound absolutely nothing alike. And that's what I mean about coming full circle. It reminds me of
that's cool.
Going to see Kill Your Idols into some metalcore band, into whatever pop punk band. So I love that about Long Island.
And are these venues you mentioned earlier growing up, are they still active? The all ages one, obviously COVID aside.
Yeah, I mean, growing up, no. There was a lot of shows at VFWs. There was like some basement venues. And I mean, like, and we're all old as hell now. So like, there's nothing around from 20 years ago or whatever. But no, I mean, that's a really good point. And I think the past couple of years, the venue situation on Long Island was a little bit rough. The bigger venue Revolution has closed from the pandemic, which sucks. And Amityville Music Hall, which is like kind of the DIY spot, is still hanging on. And hopefully there's some stuff doing. We tried to raise some money for them, and I think there's some other stuff going on that front. But that has been kind of like home base for a lot of the local Long Island shows for sure.
Yeah, it's funny. What'd you say, the Amityville Theater?
Amityville Music Hall, yeah.
Music Hall.
AMH, yeah.
So I had tickets to like Crime and Stereo's return show with I Am the Avalanche back in like 2012. And I didn't go. And we always talk about like show regrets on this podcast. And I wish I went, because that would have been my first introduction to Long Island.
Yeah, it's a cool venue. I mean, it's pretty small. It's like you think it's bigger, and it's like I've been to so many shows there that are like so like ridiculously packed you can't even move. But it's a great spot. And like I said, the people who own it get it. I think that's the thing. It's not like some shithead who's trying to like just make as much money as he can on the bar. Like, it's kids who really know what's going on. So yeah, it's a great spot, man. I hope it can survive.
So Brendan, I was searching for incendiary live clips on YouTube, and I came across the WWE performance with Code Orange. And this is, you know, kind of adjacent from our whole conversation, but I'm just curious, how the hell did that happen? I mean, was that a wild whole like experience?
Yes, it was very, yes, it was wild, extremely intense. It happened. Cliff notes are basically that the two gentlemen who basically wrote all of WWE's music, they're called the CFOs, this dude's John and Mike, our guitar player Rob was really good friends with John. John is now like one of my best friends, but lives in Greenpoint. But they were doing something for Aleister Black. Aleister like gave them kind of some guidance in terms of like the bands and the sound that he wanted for the vocals and just the music all up. And John and Mike wrote, you know, were coming up with the song ideas, and they asked me to do vocals on it. And so we got together with some other guys in the band and just kind of collaborated on like the lyrics and the structure of the song and stuff. And then, so that was the song, and it came out as, you know, it went through the WWE sort of machine to make it entrance music rather than like a song. And then I just got a call about, hey, Code Orange is playing this event. Do you want to play in Aleister live? And damn. I was like, sure. Yeah, sure. And yeah, it was pretty nuts, man. It was about as nuts as you think it is. Very highly surreal, you know, Triple H coming up to me and talking about stage presence, like before we go on, like it was highly, highly surreal. And the thing is like, I was like always liked wrestling, but Brian from Incendiary is like a huge wrestling mark. And like, so I brought him and he was sort of like my consigliere for the day and was like having the time of his life. It was an incredible experience. It really, really was.
So you grew up when we did. So you saw, I mean, you see Triple H in that situation. You remember Degeneration X and the whole.
Of course, man. Yeah, of course. No, because so many of my friends are so huge into it. I've kind of always been kind of tangentially around. I will say that it gave me an unbelievable appreciation for the world of pro wrestling from a production and just entertainment perspective. It's absolutely mind blowing, but it was a surreal day. I'll say that.
That's cool.
It was very cool. Yeah. And Alistair Tom is a really cool dude.
Nice. So I think to wrap here, we have one last question. We were talking last week. We did kind of our most anticipated music of 2021. We had some bands that were rumored. We had some bands that were confirmed. What's the future for Incendiary? Are we going to maybe see some new music here in the near future?
Yeah. I mean, like I'm assuming every other band are working on stuff. We're writing. We generally take a long time with writing, as our release calendar has shown in the past, but yeah, we are. I think everyone feels like pretty excited to do it. I think with us, like we were always very anti making it be a chore, and like because we don't do it for a living. Like I don't need to adhere to some album cycle. We do whatever the hell we want. So it has been a little bit liberating to feel like we can do whatever we want. And so we're working on stuff. We're thinking about things and nice. You know what we want to do as far as a release, but definitely stuff to come there for sure.
So Brendan, I don't know if you've checked out our podcast, but if you have, you saw the name of the episode. Maybe you haven't, but the name of the episode was "Who Will Save Us from 2020." So we're hoping it's Incendiary.
Yeah, dude, I hope so too. I mean, us and every other band. You know, it's funny. Like, there's probably going to be just like a glut of like incredible music dropping, which is so sick. I thought about that the other day. I know a lot of other bands are either working on stuff or legit sitting on completely finished records, so we want to be part of that. But it's been fun to write again, honestly, guys. Like, we put out Cost of Living a while ago. 1,000 Mile Stare was I think 2017, so it's felt good to get in the proverbial lab again.
Nice.
Yeah, like you said, there's a glut. There's just so much things to write about, right? And your music is conducive to what's going on today. Some chaotic things that you can write about, I'm assuming.
Yeah. I've been thinking about some themes and stuff. It's like, it's kind of like how it's a little bit analogous to like how like Trump is like the death of comedy, because like he's already so ridiculous that it's like hard to make a joke about him, because it's like, so insane already that it's like, you know what I mean? Yeah. It is a little bit similar to that in music, where sometimes I kind of want to like zig where others zag. And so I kind of feel like I talked about all this stuff already. But like, I'm thinking a lot about like lyrical content for sure.
That's awesome. We look forward to it, Brendan. We really appreciate you coming on tonight, man.
This was a great chat, guys. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
It was awesome.
Absolute blast.
Thank you.
Yeah. So we'll probably wrap it there. Brendan, appreciate it so much, and hopefully we'll be in touch again.
That was an awesome conversation with Brendan Grone of Incendiary, deep diving into the last 25 years or so of Long Island music, and, you know, right from the horse's mouth, from somebody who lived those shows, from somebody who started a band there. It has been around the block with that stuff. So pretty cool stuff, right, guys?
Yeah, he said it post-show more, but he said we were all kind of cut from the same cloth. And I agree. You know, if we were in the same town, we would have been going to the same shows, hanging out, doing the same things together in the general region of Long Island. And he really painted a great picture on the scene there. And it just reminded me, we kind of talk about it in the episode, like, nice, this is so relatable. And we're in a completely different scene in Maine, but like, there's not a whole lot to do. It's either all latest shows, or you go skiing, or you're playing video games. You know, one of the three, basically, because it's snowing. So to get his kind of backstory on how it all came together, and that I think the coolest thing about the episode is discovering music, like how it came about. Because we all came from that same era of you saw it in a flyer in a newspaper, you saw it on a sticker in someone's binder in study hall. You know, like it wasn't like you went on Google or you had, you know, Spotify kind of suggesting certain things. It was all very organic. So it's cool to hear that from a different perspective.
So true. And like, one of my, I don't know if it's favorite parts of the episode, but like what one part that really resonated with him was just like that false sense of like everything's in play when you live on Long Island. Like, even though it's geographically and like massive, and same thing with Maine, like those drives to the cave, I wouldn't think, granted it was, you know, I was like early 20s, but I wouldn't think twice about it. But I would never, ever, ever go to Rhode Island like at the drop of a hat. Like, it would require planning. Where like the cave was like that day, I'm like, all right, I'll go see, I don't know, Madball. I saw Madball. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, it's kind of cool. And it was cool to hear someone who came from that region and their perspective. And some of it echoed what we saw of that region from a Maine lens, but other angles was just like, oh, wow, I didn't think of that, you know?
Well, and one of those main lens things that you're talking about is Taking Back Sunday. So they became huge everywhere. And I remember watching the video for Your Soul last summer and seeing Flavor Flav in it. And we were all like, what is happening? Like, why is Flavor Flav in this Taking Back Sunday video? And it's because he's from Long Island.
Right.
Public Enemy is from Long Island. And that is, as they say, you know, Long Island roots run deep there. So that's probably how that came about, right? It's like, let's rep for each other because we're both from Long Island. So that's cool. And knowing that, you know, in research for this today, not having any clue about it 20 years ago, it's one of the fun little gems you get from doing a podcast like this.
Yeah, I want to interject on the whole drop of a hat, go to a show out of state. I was doing that all the time, man.
Well, you know, it's funny though, like from like 18 to maybe 26, yes. But once you hit like 20s, I feel like late 20s, it was like, all right, this shit needs planning. Is the weather bad?
Yeah.
Do I have an early meeting like the next day? You know what I mean?
You were adulting? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, I was a functioning adult. Like,
yeah.
But you're right.
Yeah, no.
You're right. It was just like, how am I going to get there? Who's driving? You don't even worry about, like, if it's a show that required a ticket, you didn't care about if you had one or not. You were just going. You'll find a way to get in, you know?
Nate still does that today, I think.
Exactly.
But you're right. It does change as you get a little older and you become, you know, late 20s, early 30s, and there's life to worry about the following day. Whereas, you know, you're 22, you're like, I don't care. I'll deal with tomorrow. I'm going to do this tonight. Like,
right.
It sounds like a similar upbringing that Brendan had on Long Island. It's like, yeah, it may be, you know, 60 miles that way, but let's go, or right, 90 miles that way, but we're going to go to the show tonight because that's what we do here. This is the place that we can do it. And, you know, they've had a ton of bands form and come through in his time as a music fan. So pretty cool stuff.
Yeah. When that's what you obsess over, you know, it's like a comic person, like Comic-Con every weekend, like you're going to go. If that's what you love, you're gonna check it out no matter what. But yeah, if driving out of state's a trek, but within the city, totally. And all this relatable stuff with Brendan, you know, like I wasn't into that scene, I wasn't into that music at the time, and then I revisited it later, really, really appreciate it now, and don't give a shit about how I look or if I'm gonna get judged for liking A, you know, A, B, or C, whatever. It doesn't matter anymore. So it kind of came full circle, and you like what you like, and there's a lot of good stuff out there. It doesn't have to be typecast to be appreciated, you know? So that was cool to hear from him too.
Oh, totally. Like I remember being, you know, freshman year of high school, 99, and you know, this dude's got a typo negative t-shirt and I'm like, what the fuck is that? And now like, you know, 10 years later, I'm like, oh shit, I love typo negative. Where the hell have I been? You know, where was I?
And I want to go back and talk to the kids that were wearing the shirts of the bands that I was maybe not scared of, but was like, nah. And now I'm like, no, those are good bands. Shit. I like, we would have had things in common. And that's what this is. That's what this is all about, is that community, that camaraderie you get from it. And no better person to talk about it in a place that it's pretty prevalent.
Yeah.
Brendan from Long Island. So it's cool to have heard his come up with similar to ours, even on a bigger scale, but still similar. It still felt a lot like what we had.
Yeah, it did. It totally did, because it had that, everything I gather, it has that small town vibe to it, even though it's geographically pretty big and it's populated, you know, pretty populated and whatnot. But Yeah, I think that episode really worked. I think he made that episode into something that we definitely could not have done on our own, not from that perspective. It would just we're so thankful that he was able to come on.
And hey, look out for new Incendiary and maybe late 2021. Who knows? They're in the lab, as he said. So that's exciting stuff.
Yeah, a lot to draw from, like we were talking about. You know, there's just so much subject matter just they're sitting on the table. Take it or leave it.
All right, I think we'll wrap it there, guys. If you're new to the podcast, we appreciate you checking us out this far. If you've been checking us out every week, we absolutely love it that you guys keep coming back and listening and engaging on the socials and whatnot. And we'll be back next week. More interviews, more original content, you name it, we'll be here. Thanks, everyone.
Awesome. Thanks, Podheads.
Peace, Podheads. Don't steal my line, Nate.